Our next speaker is Brother Mark Grillo, who has served us in Chicago at our small month-end conventions, but this is his first opportunity to serve at our major 2- and 3-day conventions. We're looking forward to his service. His title is a bit cryptic and will require some explanation. I'm sure he'll give it to us. Brother Mark's title is Delta Me. Delta Me. Brother Mark.
Thank you, Brother Joe. Thank you, Brother Tim, for your prayer. Hi, brethren. It is a privilege for Sister Vicki and me to be in Chicago at convention with you. It is like as though we came home to visit company at the holidays. So it's great to be here with you. And it's been a delight to stay with Brother George and Sister Florence Tabak while in the area. Their hospitality and fellowship has been an example of agape love. I do bring you the love from your brethren in New London, Connecticut, in that area, and specifically my Aunt Martha Duhame, and also I saw Brother Julius Panucci. He asked me to send his love, and also Brother David and Sister Kathy Stein. And then lastly, yesterday I had the privilege of attending the Winter Youth Seminar and working with the young people there. And parents, you should be very pleased. You have good kids. They are nice, they're kind, they're enthusiastic, and they get it. So keep up the good work, and thank you. For me, it was circa 1973. I am 16 years old, and as Robert Frost, whom I tend to think of as New England's poet laureate, phrased it, two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry, I could not travel both. But be one traveler long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I ever should come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. So in 1973, I, as many of you, took the road, the path, less taken, the narrow way. And that is making all the difference. You see, I was, as you were compelled to, as the truth began to be revealed and unveiled to us, we came to a crossroad in a decision. In the Divine Plan of the Ages, Brother Russell pens it this way in the very last chapter called Concluding Thoughts. He says, how striking then the providence of God, which at this very time opens before his children this glorious and harmonious plan, a plan that rejects not one, but harmonizes every part and item of his word. Whoever comes in contact with truth, realizing its character, has thereby a responsibility with reference to it. It must either be received and acted upon or rejected and despised. To ignore it does not release from responsibility. If we accept it ourselves, we have a responsibility toward it. So to us, just as to the disciples on their way to Emmaus, said one to another, did not our heart burn within us while we talked with, while he talked with us by the way, and while he opened to us the scriptures. This truth, this understanding, this enlightenment burned within us. It burned in our heart. So we responded. We responded affirmatively to three questions. Do you realize that you are a sinner, and as such are not able to be reconciled with God by any of your own actions? Do you accept Jesus as your own personal Savior, realizing that redemption from sin can only come through his ransom sacrifice? And three, do you, here and now, based on your answers to the two previous questions, renounce your own will and profess a full and unreserved consecration of your life to serving only the will of God, becoming a disciple of Jesus our Lord, even unto death. So how is the third question going? You've taken the road less traveled. You are in the narrow way. How is that full and unreserved consecration going? Peter says, seeing then all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness? He continues in 14, wherefore, beloved, seeing that ye look for such things, be diligent, that ye may be found of him in peace without spot and blameless. Diligent, constant in effort to accomplish something, attentive and persistent in doing anything. Wherefore, the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure. For if ye do these things, ye shall never fail. Paul writes in Romans 12:1-2, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable, perfect will of God. Now let's talk about Delta Me. You know, I must have tried about 10 titles for these thoughts. My family offered some suggestions, and you'll hear some of them as we continue. The one I really preferred was Going from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. But I thought that was going to be hard to get onto the CD label. So I went with Delta Me. Delta is the fourth letter of the Greek alphabet. It's a triangle or a pyramid. In science, it is used as a symbol that represents change. If I were doing a science experiment and had to monitor and record a change in temperature, I would take an initial temperature, allow the change, and then take an ending temperature. The difference would be recorded as delta T, the change in temperature. So as I monitor my own consecration, my own Christ-likeness, if I were able, I might record my starting performance and then my ending performance. The change would be delta me, the change in me. Now, maybe in the end, this is probably not much more than an anthology of my reflections, Brother Mark's musings on spiritual growth. But regardless, I hope these thoughts will inspire your own reflections as you stand at the threshold of a set of another 365 new days as the Lord gives us a brand new year. Here's a table of contents of sorts as we take this spiritual amble. We'll read a couple of poems. We'll tell a couple of stories. We'll try to visit with Nehemiah and Asa. We will speak to the sisters. We'll speak to the parents. We'll speak to the elders, all as time allows. And we will ask some questions, and we will challenge you to grow. And my objective, to be your cheerleader, so that when you wake up on Tuesday, January 1st, 2013, you are ready to be more Christ-like and to live your consecration more vigorously than ever before. You know, once again, earlier this month, we were reminded in Newtown, Connecticut, just how sinful and evil this world is, with the loss of 27 lives, most between the ages of 4 and 10. A world that in 20 years can shape an individual to carry out such an atrocity. And the natural response of good people is, how can we help? How can we make a positive difference? And you, brethren, have chosen the only real and effective course. And that is to work, to support, and to usher in God's kingdom. You are the light of the world and the salt of the earth. And when you make your calling and election sure, then you will be able to help raise up this world. Linda Ellis wrote the following poem. I read of a man who stood to speak at the funeral of a friend. He referred to the dates on her tombstone from beginning to end. He noticed that first came the date of her birth and spoke the following date with tears. But he said what mattered most of all was the dash between the years. For the dash represents all the time that she spent alive on earth, and now only those who loved her know what that little line is worth. For it matters not how much we own, the cars, the house, the cash. What matters is how we live and love and how we spend our dash. So think about this long and hard, and there are things you'd like to change, for you never know how much time is left that can still be rearranged. If you could just slow down enough to consider what's true and real and always try to understand the way other people feel and be less quick to anger and show appreciation more and love the people in our lives like we never loved before. If we treat each other with respect and more often wear a smile, remembering that this special dash might only last a little while. So when your eulogy is being read with your life's actions to rehash, would you be proud of the things they say about how you spent your dash? See, brethren, God is on a mission. He is looking for a very select group of people on the face of this earth in order to strongly support them as they endeavor to help him unfold his plan. Wouldn't we so much want to be one of them? So when your eulogy is being read with your life's actions to rehash, would you be pleased of the things they say about how you spent your dash? Well done, good and faithful servant. Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 16:9 says, "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth, throughout this auditorium, to show himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect towards him." God is on a mission. He is looking for a very select group of people in order to strongly support them as they endeavor to help him unfold his plan. Ezekiel 22:30 says, "And I sought for a man among them that should make up the hedge and stand in the gap before me for the land, that I should not destroy it." God is looking for that very select group of people to strongly support them as they endeavor to help him unfold his plan. You see, throughout time, God has sought out people, people who were different, people who were ready to carry out his purposes to help him unfold his plan and his will. Peter calls them a peculiar people. Was it Noah or Joseph or Moses or Daniel or Peter or Paul or you? Wouldn't you so much like to be one of those faith-filled individuals whose mind is stayed on him? Paul writes to Timothy, "Meditate upon these things. Give thyself wholly to them, that thy profiting may appear to all." Mahatma Gandhi said, "Be the change that you wish to see in the world." And for sure, Gandhi is one of the most respected and peaceful leaders of modern history, for not only his life, but for his ideals and his message to the people. And although Hindu, Gandhi had a very close connection with Christianity and admired Jesus very much, and he often quoted from the Sermon on the Mount. But when the missionary E. Stanley Jones met with Gandhi, he asked him, "Mr. Gandhi, though you quote the words of Christ often, why is it that you appear to so adamantly reject becoming his follower?" Gandhi replied, "Oh, I don't reject Christ. I like your Christ. I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." He continued, "If Christians would really live according to the teachings of Christ, as found in the Bible, all of India would be Christian today." Brethren, our Christianity is not a sprint. It is a marathon. 1 Corinthians 9, "Know you not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that ye may obtain. I therefore so run not as uncertainly, so fight I not as one that beateth the air. It is said that running is a mental sport. You can train hard, follow a healthy diet, wear all the right clothes and shoes, but if you're not in the proper mindset, nothing you've done to prepare matters. Different people have different ideas about the role of mental preparation. Some say it's 80% physical, 20% mental, while others say 20% physical, 80% mental. The point is that there is a mind-body connection, and you can't underestimate that mental piece. For us, it is a spirit over matter, spirit over flesh. You must have motivation to run. Nothing can make you move your legs down the path if your head and heart are just not into it. Nothing can make you daily live out your consecration. You must want to. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. Brethren, who of you have been consecrated for more than 30 years? If you would raise your hand, bear with me for a second. More than 30 years. Now, if it's been more than 50 years, please put your hands down, keep your hands up. How about if it's been more than 60 years? How many have been consecrated for more than 60 years? Any 70s? More than 70 years? You know, our journey is not a sprint, it's a marathon. One question seems to arise: how old do you really have to be to understand what long suffering means? In an article written called "The Managing the Middle Miles" about marathons, it says the difficulty of the middle miles is this: they are neither the beginning miles, where control is clear, the priorities are clear, nor the final miles, where the mandate of survival lends crystal clarity to the task at hand. The middle miles are a transition where elements of both the beginning and the end exist concurrently, where ideals meet harsh reality, and where the runner must make critical decisions and commitments. Now, I'm not a runner. For me, the phenomenon has been the experience the few times I've been able to go hiking. When our children, Noah and Faith, were younger, it became an annual event for us to hike Mount Washington. It frequently marked the beginning of the school year. The total hike was about 8 miles, and for me, there were three parts: the beginning, the middle, and the end. In the beginning, we were fresh. The thought of being there was exciting. The morning was new and cool. Our clothes and gear were fresh and clean. Life was good. At the end, we could see the summit. The views were great. We knew we were almost there. The middle, though, was the challenge. Often the heat of the day began to have its effects. Often the weather, or from the weather or the sweat of our shoes, were getting wet and beginning to present challenges to our feet and comfort. We were still in the trees, so we could not yet see the summit or the view that marked that we were close. It was here, in the middle, that the hike became the most mental. The way I describe it at this point, it was just a matter of putting one foot in front of the other. I sometimes find the middle of my consecration similar. I sometimes find the greatest battle being just keeping on. Brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Your head is down. Your mind is working hard just to stay on the goal. Sometimes I feel like Charles Schultz when he wrote, "Just when I thought I had all the answers, they went and changed all the questions." You frequently are reminded of aches and pains and discomfort, which when commingled with the fact that you still have a ways to go, the biggest battle becomes what I hear when the apostle says, "Having done all, stand and stand and stand yet some more." I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Therefore, brethren, we are debtors not to the flesh to live after the flesh. For if we live after the flesh, ye shall die. But if through the Spirit do mortify the deeds of the body, ye shall live. My thanks to Brother John, remembering Laodicea, the time is short. Be careful not to be lukewarm. Brethren, what do we have to give to God? Really, all we have is our time and how we choose to use it. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God. That is your reasonable service. And we've all probably heard the problem with a living sacrifice is it keeps trying to crawl off the altar. Let's take a quick visit to Nehemiah. It was about 444 B.C., this time that peculiar person ready to do God's work was Nehemiah. The story of Nehemiah is a wonderful account of overcoming circumstances to accomplish something great. And isn't that what we are all about, overcoming the flesh to build God's church? In Nehemiah 1, Nehemiah receives a report. They said to me, those who survived the exile are back in the province, are in great trouble and in disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. All of us have at some time and to some degree experienced having the walls to our heart torn down by the enemy. The heart is like a city which must be protected from the enemy. When the walls are broken down, the enemy has access to our minds, our emotions, our will. He comes in to deceive our minds into thinking wrong thoughts. He comes in to stir up our emotions with anger, confusion, depression, and bitterness. The adversary will set up strongholds of lies within the city of our soul, which must be torn down. We must confront the lies with the word of God, bind and cast out the enemy, then begin to work on rebuilding the walls. When Nehemiah first hears about the remnant remaining from the captivity, he hears that they were in great affliction and reproach. This may be you or me today. Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant and to the prayer of thy servants who desire to fear thy name. And prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. Nehemiah's prayer in Nehemiah 1:11. See, Nehemiah was a Hebrew in Persia when the word reached him that the temple in Jerusalem was being reconstructed. He grew anxious knowing there was no wall to protect the city. So in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, Nehemiah, the king's cupbearer, was asked by the king, why are you so sad? And Nehemiah related to him the blight of the Jewish people and that the city of Jerusalem was undefended. Nehemiah invited God to use him to save the city. Not a prophet, not a priest, just a businessman, invited God to use him to save the city. God answered his prayer by softening the heart of the Persian king, who gave him not only his blessing, but the supplies to continue the project. And in spite of opposition and accusations, the wall was built and the enemy silenced. The people were inspired by Nehemiah, and the wall was completed in a remarkable 52 days. Nehemiah chose to do with his what to do with his time. God gave him the resources. Nehemiah could have said, they took that restoration project on themselves. Let them worry about it. I'm the king's cupbearer. I go to meetings, I'm a good guy, I have a job, I'm busy, and as our camp song goes on, I've married a wife and bought me a cow. I have fields and commitments that cost a pretty sum. I certainly couldn't go. But Nehemiah was concerned enough to act. Nehemiah could have been very complacent, wrapped up in himself, his own life, his own family, his own affairs. But his story shows he was concerned and did something about it. How is your life invested in God's work. Are you about your Father's business? How are you spending your time, your resources, the resources God gave back to you at your consecration to use in His service? How are you spending your dash, and what will be your legacy? Not too long ago, our ecclesia had been involved in a study in Volume 6, and most specifically the chapter dealing with parental obligations. And I'd have to confess that it had been some time since I had revisited the chapter and was rather pessimistic of the value it was going to have for me personally. But I found this to be grandly erroneous and was astounded at some of its advice. Having opened the chapter with statements that essentially say that it seems sometimes people put more thought into how they will breed their livestock than who they will marry or how they will raise their children, in continuing with an alarming treatise on formal and higher education, Brother Russell sets his sights on play. What does and should children's play look like? Now, young people that I met with yesterday, you can cover your ears now before you get mad at me later. As for play, I'm going to read quite a bit, but I think it's valuable. One of the chief advantages from play is the pleasurable exercise connected with it. For it is undoubtedly a fact that exercise taken with pleasure is much more profitable than exactly the same exercise would be if taken as a drudgery. By some unknown chemistry of our systems, the mind and its moods have to do with all the functions of life. Our happy moods cooperate best with all the forces and functions of nature for the upbuilding of our systems and the repairing of its wastes. But it is a mistaken idea that insists that that which is useful is a drudgery, and only that which is useless is a pleasure, a play. We are of the opinion that a wrong thought connected with this matter has led many reasonable people to cultivate playfulness and idleness, when on the contrary, they should have been resisting the natural impulses of the fallen nature in these directions. As parents, adults, we should endeavor to the making of instruction pleasurable to the child, and all subsequent pleasure favored by the wise parent should be somewhat along the same line. Nothing should be approved that is merely a waste of time and energy. He continues, relaxation and recreation should be secured chiefly through the change of occupation rather than through the idleness of useless exercise. Bear with me. The little girl takes pleasure in dressing her doll and caring for it and playing house. The little boy plays shop and with sand. As substitutes, he makes imaginary dealings in tea and coffee and sugar and potatoes, or he plays horse and teamster, or imagines himself a preacher or a missionary or a school teacher or a doctor. All such plays are in the right direction and should be encouraged in the little ones. As they grow older, they should be drawn from these to consider it as a part of their recreation to help keep the home in order to assist the real store or shop or with their parents or guardians or others. If they be taught to take pleasure in usefulness, helpfulness to others, financially or otherwise, if they be taught that idleness is a sin and a shame, a discredit to any person, and a waste of valuable opportunities, they will be in a proper attitude to face the duties of life with pleasure, and not to envy those who waste both time and money. It's Brother Russell. In looking at a ball game, or in participating in something equally foolish and profitless. Now, before you start to say, yeah, but that was written a long time ago. You see, I believe Brother Russell was specifically used by God. He brought meaning and clarity to God's plan. meet in due season, and I am very careful to listen to his advice. Paul the Apostle, we believe, is not married, yet offers significant advice about marriage and relationships. What do we do with that? So you see, Laodicea, we are rich and wanting for nothing. We need to be careful. Our time is the only thing we have to offer the Lord. How are you using yours? I have a couple of challenges that I'm going to suggest. This is challenge one. We, as a culture and a society, have become desensitized. By the time the average child is 18 years old, they will have watched 200,000 acts of violence and 16,000 murders. 89% of the top-selling video games had content of violent nature. 97% of relationships seen in the media are between men and women who are not married. From the American Academy of Pediatrics, a committee on public education, American children between 2 and 18 years of age spend an average of 6 hours and 32 minutes each day using media, television, commercials, or self-recorded videos, movies, and so forth, the internet. This is more time than they spend on any other activity with the exception of sleeping. And as adults, we say, yeah, but I can filter the good from the bad. But does that negate the effect? The challenge is this. For 10 days, not doesn't have to be the next 10 days, give yourself 5, 10, 15 minutes of radio news and then turn the rest off. No TVs, no movies, no radios, no games, and if you can do it, stay out of the mall. And after the 10 days, if you return, see how resensitized you will be. If you already do this, I applaud you. If not, I challenge you. Friends, our thinking is daily being skewed by the media, television, books, magazines, newspaper, sales ads, all of these things telling us what and how we want to think, what we should look like, how we should dress, how we are to act, what marriage should look like, what is right. Millions, billions of advertising dollars are spent to keep us discontent with what we have and striving for what we must have. And we have become desensitized. The term we use called cognitive dissonance. A classic example of the idea is the Aesop fable called The Fox and the Grapes. It's where we get our term sour grapes. In the story, a fox sees some high-hanging grapes and wishes to eat them. When the fox is unable to think of a way to reach them, he must come up with excuses for why his initial premise was not wrong, so he surmises that the grapes are probably not worth eating anyway, and as they must not be ripe, and they're probably sour. This example follows a pattern. One who desires something finds it unattainable and reduces one's dissonance, the way they think about it, by criticizing it. I like to call it making excuses. Because it's often easier to make excuses than it is to change behavior. The dissonance theory leads to the conclusions that humans are rationalizing and not always rational beings. The question is still, how are we spending our dash? And how is question three going? What is keeping us from following through and making it happen? The road to weeping and gnashing of teeth, the road to disappointment is paved with good intentions. One commentator, Chip Ingram, says, there seems to be this certain psychology about good intentions. It seems that at times when people have a genuine, sincere desire to do something good, and you really believe you are going to do it, you think you've actually accomplished something because you have the desire. Do you see where this is going? It's It's like I really want to witness more. I really want to study more. I really want to address that issue in my character. See, I really haven't done anything, but I wish to. And that's a big step in getting there. And so I think what happens is that we think we did something when what we did was we got aligned to do something. Brother Russell in reprint 3820 says, sternly, we want to put you all on notice that the shaking and sifting process, so far from being over and past, is bound to progress more and more until all have been tried and tested thoroughly. So when your eulogy is being read with your life's actions to rehash, what will be your legacy? God is on a mission looking for a very select group of people on the face of this earth in order to strongly support them as they endeavor to help him unfold his plan. One of the great examples in my personal cloud of witnesses was Sister Gloria Luce. For 20 years, Sister Gloria and her husband Art Luce gave the East Coast Bible Students Youth Camp a home. It was boldly evident the remarkable effort and effect this one sister had on so many. Sisters, when you are feeling discouraged and constrained and confined, this one sister with a holy ambition and utilizing the sentiments of the Lord, as he spoke to Moses, and the Lord said unto him, what is that in thine hand? And he said, a rod, provided an opportunity for a very great work. For Moses, it was a rod. For Sister Gloria, it was a home. And as a result, so many lives were blessed. For about 20 years, the Luces became synonymous with the East Coast Camp, and as such, helped hundreds of young people to make straight paths for their feet. For nearly as many now, and for a whole new set of campers, that torch and legacy has been continued through the efforts of Brother Tony and Sister Harriet Simonis. Wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Brethren, what will our dash look like? What will be our legacy? Elders, I believe we have a stake in this. We being apt to teach, teaching and education being a change in behavior, our brethren come out frequently twice a week to attend meetings. They leave the comfort of their homes. They sacrifice the myriad of other things they might spend their time on in this very hectic world. It is our responsibility to send them off, one, feeling as though it was good to be there, and two, ready to be changed, ready to become different than when they walked in. Sister Vicki and I call these 100-mile meetings. 100-mile meetings. And I don't think that's original. I think we heard that. Sister Vicki and I drive about 12 miles to get to meetings. But I remember when we lived out west, we heard of brethren who might drive 100 miles to get to a meeting. Those brethren better feel as though it was worth that drive. But just because we may only have a driving short distance to get to our meetings, we should have 100-mile meetings planned for them, planned for our brethren, meetings worth driving 100 miles for. Going back to this commentator, Ingram, you know, he talks about us setting idols up in our lives. He says, I don't make idols. I can't remember the last time I went home and said, excuse me, honey, I'm going to the back bedroom, going to bow down to the statue in the kid's bedroom 45 times. I think it might do me some good. We don't do that. You don't do that. I don't do that. But yet we run the risk of creating our own idols. We take the creator of the universe, who is all wise and powerful, and we shrink him down, and what we do is treat God as though he is our self-help genie. Instead of worshiping him and knowing him and us understanding and supporting what he wants and his mission and following him by faith, not being able to see, we little by little kind of work the verses around and we come to the conclusion that the real goal in life is for us to be happy. Happy, happy, happy. The real goal in life becomes our fulfillment. Ultimately, what we're saying is that what we worship is our own happiness. What we've set as most important is our personal fulfillment, and we have created and reduced Jehovah to a God who is supposed to fulfill our agenda. We have a little molten calf. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. We are disciples. We follow him, and we die to ourselves daily, and the promise is not prosperity here and now. The promise is in the world there will be tribulation, but be of good cheer. I am with you, and I will give you peace, and I will help you through the troubled world. I will give you grace. Are our prayers promise-centered or problem-centered? Are your prayers problem-centered or promise-centered? Brethren, the Creator of the universe has called you his children, not servants. We have been invited to call him Abba, Father. For ye receive not, Romans 8:15, we receive not the spirit of bondage again unto fear, but ye receive the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father. And because ye are sons, God sent forth the spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. How frequently do you ponder the magnitude of God, his plan, and our invitation? To Job, he said, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare, if you have understanding, the great creator of the universe. And we are invited to come before him as children. Challenge number two. I'm asking for 180 seconds. There are 24 hours in a day, 1,440 minutes, 86,400 seconds. For 180 of them, as you go before God in prayer, as you approach the throne of grace, before you speak to God, pause for 180 seconds and consider the grandeur of the Creator of the universe and who you are speaking with. You know, as we read through Chronicles, it seems to be this sort of bad king, bad king, bad king, good king. And after Solomon and the kingdom split, there was Rehoboam, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. And then Abijah, of whom there's not a lot said, but it's claimed that he had 20-some wives. And then there was Asa. Asa was generally good. In 2 Chronicles 14:1 and 2, so Abijah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And Asa, his son, reigned in his stead. In his days, the land was quiet 10 years. And Asa did that which was good and right in the eyes of the Lord. And Asa had an army of men that bare targets and spears. And Asa cried unto the Lord his God and said, Lord, it is nothing with thee to help, whether with many or with them that have no power. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rest on thee, and in thy name we go against this multitude. O Lord, thou art our God, let not man prevail against thee. To me, that's right up there with David. Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defiled. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand. So the Lord smote the Ethiopians before Asa and before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. And then the prophet Oded came to Asa, and he went out to meet Asa and said unto him, Hear ye me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while ye be with him. The Lord is with you while ye be with him. And if ye seek him, he will be found in you. But if ye forsake him, he will forsake you. And when Asa heard these words in the prophecy of Oded, the prophet, he took courage and put away the abominable idols out of all the land of Judah and Benjamin. Brethren, it is no different for us. We must put away our idols, whatever they may be, that distracts us from God and our commitment, and take courage, remembering Paul wrote, if God be for us, who can be against us? Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. If we could but keep in memory the fact that every trial, every persecution, every difficulty of life permitted to come upon those who have made the covenant of sacrifice with the Lord is intended to prove them, to test their love, to see whether or not their characters are fixed and rooted and grounded in righteousness and being built upon in love. It would put all these trials, difficulties, and temptations in a new light before us and greatly assist us in fighting a good fight and overcoming. We would say, if by these little trials the Lord is proving my love and devotion to him, then however trifling they may be or however important, I will diligently use them as favorable opportunities to demonstrate to my Lord the fullness of my love and devotion to him in his cause. In reprint 5120, Brother Russell says, anyone solicitous of maintaining his rights and holding on to the present life and unwilling to sacrifice all will lose the great prize of the divine nature, which will be given to those who do take up the cross and make a full sacrifice of earthly interests. And on the other hand, he who will faithfully lose his life for Jesus' sake will save it, will gain the reward of life on the spirit plane. Brethren, how are we spending our dash? How are you doing with question 3? His Lord said unto him, Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of the Lord. This year, in 2013, what will be your Delta U? And as always, may God add his blessing.